This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Rima Hanna is Jeffrey Chia Professor of Southeast Asia Studies at the Harvard Kennedy School. Part of her research focuses on understanding how to improve the provision of public services in developing countries, particularly for the very poor. Currently, she's been working on a series of field projects to understand what types of individuals are selected to receive social programs under different forms of targeting mechanisms. She joins me now in the studio to discuss her research. Rima, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me here today.
So, Jeffrey Chia, Professor of Southeast Asia Studies, what do you cover within that specialty?
So it's very exciting. I just became the Jeffrey Chia Professor of Southeast Asia Studies last year. Before that, I was a professor at Harvard for 9 years, and then before that at NYU for several years as well. Most of my work focuses on thinking about how we can improve public policy, particularly how do we think about using data and evidence to make better informed policy decisions. And much of my work focuses in Indonesia, where I'm the scientific director of a research institute at the University of Indonesia, to try to build that research base. And our research institute in Indonesia technically covers the Southeast Asia region. And so while many of our projects are currently only in Indonesia, and some of our researchers also work in the Philippines, I'm hoping to use the opportunity, the connections here at Senway University, to also try to expand the work we're doing to other countries in the region.
You majored in policy analysis at Cornell, which has one of the best Southeast Asia programs in the world. Is this where your interest in the region was piqued? Because, you know, Southeast Asia and Harvard, it's not necessarily immediately apparent how that relationship kind of got forged.
So that's a great question. So Cornell does have one of the best Southeast Asia departments. I actually must say it was not there. So when I was, I came to my career in sort of a very roundabout path. So I originally thought I would be a lawyer working on social issues in Washington, D.C., trying to think about how do you improve policy for the poor in the U.S. And then when I was in college, I got very excited by the idea of economics and thinking about not just making legal arguments and arguments, but actually thinking about how do we use the evidence to actually make the debate better informed. And so I initially, at that point, I had never even left the United States before. My family had immigrated from to the U.S., but I was born there, and I had never been outside of the U.S., and I never had that opportunity. And so after college, I had my first opportunity to travel abroad. And because my background is Middle Eastern, we went to Egypt. And I was fascinated to learn so much about other cultures and to see the problems people were facing and how similar, but also the differences from what we saw in the U.S. And I became very interested in working in other countries. And initially, I started working. I had projects in India. And then at one point, there was a possibility of working in a project in Indonesia. And I said, sure, why not? And who knew that 10 years later, I would go to Indonesia 2 to 3 times a year, have so many connections to the country, just because, as you know, it's a wonderful country. I've worked with some really amazing people who really want to do really amazing things. And, you know, once you start on one project, it leads to the next. And it's sort of how I found my way.
Southeast Asia, as a term, I mean, it covers a lot of different countries with a lot of different cultural backgrounds involved in them as well. And it's evolved from a geographical expression in the 30s to one with political and intellectual dimensions today. How does the region's history influence your thinking and your approach and your work here?
So I think it actually matters quite a bit. I, having worked mostly in Indonesia, I know the history well, but not only the history, but the culture, the development of institutions, how the policy debate is structured. And I also at this point, having, you know, spent a lot of time also working in the country, know a lot of people who are working in government and academia and connected to that policy scene. And you really want to entrench yourself in the policy debate to know what are the right research questions to be working on. So as I want to start doing even more work in other countries, I think it's important not just to recognize that, you know, Southeast Asia has a history, but the history of all the countries are so diverse that as you start working in a new area, there's so much to learn.
On that note, you're here in Malaysia to present your findings on how outsourcing can improve government services. Could you give us a brief preview of what you'll be presenting?
Sure. So as you mentioned at the beginning, I have done a lot of research on thinking about how do you provide services, targeted services to the very poor. And so one big challenge is actually how do you find the poor? Oftentimes, they're not in formal labor markets. There's no record of their incomes and so forth. And so I've done a lot of work on what we call targeting, which is basically identifying people below the poverty line. But then once you spend a lot of time working on targeting, you realize that once you find the right person, they don't necessarily get what they need to get. And there's lots of different reasons why. And so we had been working with the government of Indonesia trying to think about how do we ensure that the social protection, the safety net programs actually get to the targeted poor. And so we were working on Raskin, which is a rice subsidy program. Somebody who's poor is supposed to be able to get 15 kgs of rice at about a fifth of the market price each month. But in reality, poor households that are eligible only get about a third of what they're supposed to receive. So it's a really inefficient way to redistribute because you're spending lots and lots of money and only a small portion is getting to the poor. So we worked on a number of different studies to try to actually change that. And on this one, what we said is part of the problem is that this last mile delivery, service delivery, that things get lost along the way, people get charged higher prices, in part because the local government might have a monopoly over the service distribution. So we tested out in a large-scale field experiment what happens if you allow private sector delivery at the last mile. What would happen? Would more get into the hands of the poor? Would the price be lowered? And it was actually interesting. It was a very interesting research project because we did find, in effect, the price got lowered to the poor, so they got the rice at a cheaper rate. But it didn't prevent a lot of the leakage, a lot of the rice missing along the way. And part of that, and you know, as we studied the evidence and data, is we showed the ways in which the political economy prevented the private sector from doing things that they were supposed to do in some cases. And so it tells a story of, you know, more competition by allowing the outsourcing to private companies might help with the distribution, but you have to be careful about how you design these regulations to make sure that that kind of private sector competition can actually take hold.
How do we define the very poor, especially from country to country? Because somebody who's very poor in, for example, the United States might not be very poor in Indonesia or the Philippines.
So that's a good question. There's so much debate on how to do this. And different countries have different methodologies. One standard around the world is to look at a particular bundle of goods to create a living standard. And so people tag these in different ways in terms of how they define those goods. It creates different poverty lines in different countries. Even within Indonesia, when I say poverty line, technically the poverty line is different in each district because of these same differences, not just across countries, but within.
So in other words, it has to be relatively not individualized, but specialized in order to be most efficient. Is that a fair statement in terms of kind of identifying people and then getting them the services they need?
Yeah, in many ways, I think it does. We had done some research that was actually quite interesting, trying to understand what people within communities thought about how to define poverty. And so we did these field studies where to provide the transfer program, so to provide a cash transfer program, in some cases we would use some data-driven approach, which is typically used in most countries where the governments come in and interview people about their assets and income versus having communities come in and decide, oh, these people are the people who are actually poor. And when you compare the characteristics, it's very interesting because people, at least in the case of Indonesia, people chose on characteristics that was slightly different than just income. So, for example, if you had two families with the same income level, but one family, the father had a much lower education, they were more likely to be listed as poor by the community because they were more vulnerable. in the future, even though right now they have the same income level. And so communities, it's not just even what data or what bundle. There's often a difference in terms of what people feel is important in terms of how they do redistribution.
Before we continue talking about your work in Indonesia, I was just curious about something. You
Sure.
kind of shifted over to economics from law because Yeah. of kind of wanting to make a difference, wanting to approach Yeah. social issues. Are you happy with that decision? Because looking at the work that you're doing, it's sort of very specific and very very solutions driven. Whereas I suppose if you had gone on to work in the legal sphere, it would have been perhaps more policy based, sort of more mm-hmm. conceptual. So how has that kind of decision panned out for you?
You know, I think that's a good question. I think it was the right choice for me. And I'll explain maybe a little bit about why. So in some sense, a lot of what I do is actually first, it's not even just focusing on the solution. It's first diagnosing the problem. And oftentimes a lot of policy debates, you know, a lot of law debates, a lot of political science debates are all about, there's a lot of underlying issues going on, but we first have to understand the economic model of how people behave and bring in psychology as well into the fold, understand how people behave, make predictions about what the problem is and why behavior is this particular way, and then bring data and evidence in to understand it, and then to try out different solutions and to diagnose it. And so for me, you know, it's actually the kind of work I do, it's nice because it combines the two sides of my personality. One side, wanting to be activist and really do things and go out there and trying to make a difference in the world. And the other side that thinks about things in terms of logic and making sure the numbers all match up. And so combining the two in the kind of work I do, I can think about how do we figure out what's wrong and create solutions that are cost effective in trying to do the most we can do to actually improve the lives of those who are most vulnerable.
I'm speaking today with Rima Hanna, Jeffrey Chia Professor of Southeast Asia Studies at the Harvard Kennedy School. We're talking about how to improve the provision of public services in developing countries, particularly for the very poor, as well as Rima's research projects. Up next, we find out more about the work she's doing in Indonesia and Jakarta. You are listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. In the studio with me today, Rima Hanna, Jeffrey Chia, Professor of Southeast Asia Studies at the Harvard Kennedy School. We're talking about her work and projects today. And rapid urbanization, you've talked about, working in Indonesia, and Jakarta is one of the world's just busiest cities. And it does place tremendous pressure on government services. Jakarta's population went from slightly over 500,000 in the 1930s to over 13 million by the mid-2000s. How does one begin to devise a solution under these circumstances?
Oh, God, that's such a big question. I think there are a lot of different challenges in providing urban services and water, access to affordable housing, electricity, traffic. And I think it takes a lot of different ministries and a lot of different people trying to work jointly together to think about how do you create effective solutions. But I think as part of it, one thing you want to do is really think about what are the particular challenges in the setting to that you want to solve and trying to measure them so that when you actually test out different solutions, you actually figure out if you're having an effect. So for example, so I work a lot in Jakarta, so I'm very affected by the traffic, which is worse in the world. And it's very exciting right now because there's currently a lot going on in terms of improving the amount of buses going through, trying out different methodologies to improve traffic by closing off certain U-turns, and lots of things happening right now, and the building of the metro system and hopefully moving to electronic road payments to mediate traffic. And so one of the things that's been important for me is that we've been collecting data on traffic patterns and understanding sort of the behavior of the traffic. And as they've tested out different policy alternatives, we've been looking at what are the effect of these different policies, how does it affect the travel routes that people take. And this has led to newer research, which I'm just starting, which I'm very excited about, trying to think about, well, how do you try to encourage people to do things such as carpooling or use public transportation? And so I think it's, there's small things you do and you do your part, and hopefully you add up all these small things and they come to some sort of change.
We spoke earlier about the challenges of identifying the very poor and their different needs, not just from country to country, but community to community. However, are there differences in how developed and developing countries should approach social welfare?
I think there are. So, for example, one interesting fact to know is that actually richer countries spend more on social welfare than poorer ones, partly because they have the resources, partly because of the effects of growth on inequality. And so it's important to note that for countries that are emerging, such as Indonesia, such as Malaysia, the idea of social protection and safety nets are going to become more important. But given that, it's more challenging to do in emerging countries because of the data environment. So, for example, in the United States, if you want to identify a poor person to provide them with transfers, there's a paper system in terms of employment and jobs because people are in the formal labor market, and a large part of our social transfer, our cash transfers, are done through the tax system because most everybody is brought into the tax system. But in countries that are emerging, that have a higher level of rural population and tend to be more data poor in terms of the way the labor market functions, those people are really hard to reach and to verify their actual income levels because there's no records and you have to find them in other ways. And so there's a host of different variety of methods to do that. Even then, of what you decide to give and how much you decide to give and when you decide to give it, it's all going to depend on what the current state of the economy looks like. And so in some ways, it's not just there are differences between rich and poor, but there are also differences across countries and across contexts that you want to be cognizant of as you design a full safety net strategy.
What are some basic ways, in your opinion, that we could be using to strengthen social safety nets for the poor?
So I think the first step, and this is the one that's it's not the most exciting, but it's the one that I think is very important, is actually to improve the mechanisms to identify the poor and to really make sure that there's a good targeting system in place, because regardless of what you give, you need to first start with actually identifying the poor. And that's, I think, the challenge of many countries that are in emerging.
Your research, there is also this prevailing notion that welfare corrupts the poor, this idea that, you're not giving them the chance to kind of get back on their own feet and things like that, and that government handouts make people lazy. But your research reveals otherwise. Could you tell us more?
Sure. So there is this strain of thought, this stereotype that the poor are lazy and that you give them handouts and they're going to spend it on tobacco and booze. And I think, if you look at most of the research on this topic's been done on the U.S., if you look at that, the main thing you see is you sometimes see poor people working a little less, but the effect is very, very small, and it's probably not big enough relative to the benefits of these programs. What we did is we said, what about, looking at this kind of evidence across the world? And so we tried to find all the top studies where they did evaluations, really rigorous evaluations of cash transfer programs, and included from Southeast Asia, included Indonesia and the Philippines, which have done really great studies of their work. And we reanalyzed the data, including getting all the labor market information, and we found no effect. And I think that's very interesting because for several reasons. So first of all, if you actually look at the people who qualify for these programs, they're often working. They're just not earning enough to sustain the family. So to begin with, a large majority of the families are actually in some sort of informal labor market. The second issue is that I think one thing that might play a role in emerging countries is the nature of the targeting. In rich countries, as soon as if you give out a welfare payment, as soon as it shows that you got a job or you earn a job, you lose that welfare payment because we can identify right away the difference between the two, and that creates a disincentive effect. But when it's actually harder to identify the poor, you do it based on the assets the household has. Once you're eligible for longer. So you don't actually get a penalty if you get a job. You just get more money. And I think that's generating these effects we see, that it's not really changing people's labor market behavior, but it's giving them a little bit of a leg up. And it's actually then both not changing labor market behavior, but helping with things like education and improving health outcomes for kids. And so it actually is on net. It's on net of our, it's a positive.
Well, the information about, you know, how these things work and the specific communities mm-hmm. comes from the United States. The bias, I would say, mm-hmm. is near global. I mean, it might vary yeah. a little, but the basic idea that welfare is for the lazy or that, you know, I don't know, these sorts of biases, why do you think they've become so entrenched worldwide?
Oh, God, that's a hard question. I think part of it is, I mean, my own view is that the theory says it could go that way. Theory says that you could have a disincentive effect. Again, it depends on how exactly you design the program to get the disincentive effect, but the theory says that. But we can't just rely on the theory, and that's why I'm so interested in also thinking about what the evidence says, because we want to test if the theory is true or not. But then once the theory is out there and you do bring evidence in the fold, it's also hard to change people's initial beliefs. And so then it really is about informing them about what the evidence says and really showing the value of it. I think the other reason why is that you could design a welfare, like a transfer program that disincentivizes people to work, and you can try to design one that tries to minimize incentives. So it's also really, it's about the details of the policy and the program. It's about how you design it. And those kind of subtleties are often lost in the policy debate where people just say, oh, this program is going to cause people not to work, rather than thinking about, well, can we design it in ways that both give us the benefits for kids, but also make sure that we don't have huge disincentive effects. And so I think that it's very subtle in terms of thinking about policy. And I think oftentimes there's a lot of rhetoric that goes on around policy rather than really thinking carefully through and trying to think about what the data tells us.
Unfortunately, even with income inequality, it does mean that economic growth, even if it's present, doesn't benefit an entire country equally. When designing anti-poverty programs, how do you avoid leakage or, you know, just inefficiencies?
Oh, God, that's you. You keep asking me these really big questions. I mean, there's different things you can do. First of all, you know, one thing that we found actually that works really well, at least in Indonesia, is just informing people what they're eligible for. And it's amazing the level of corruption that fell and the amount of leakage dropped dramatically once people actually were informed that they were indeed eligible and what they were eligible for and demanded their rights. I think other things which I think are very exciting, which are changing right now, is the idea that we can start using newer technologies to, you know, instead of right now, you know, doing, for example, food subsidy programs where you're giving out food and half of it falls off the truck, we could start thinking about doing electronic transfers directly to people's cell phones and trying to test out and understand how we can use these new technologies that, you know, are, you know, now coming to rural areas as well to leverage this enthusiasm and to really make sure things get into the hands of people who need it, I think can be really exciting.
And in looking at this, a phrase came up that I thought was interesting, elite capture. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Oh, so this is so there's different types of ways you can have leakage. One way is that things just go missing and you don't know where it goes. Rice falling off trains. Another way is what people often worry about is that that you can have local leaders who will give the transfers to their family rather than the people who are poor. So, for example, in Indonesia, we saw that when you give communities more leeway into them choosing who should get the transfer payments as opposed to just relying on the data, you do see some elite capture. You see village leaders give it to their relatives. But to be honest, their relatives are not that much richer, and there's very few of them. So in terms of the magnitude of the problem, it's not that large. The bigger problem is the data of not getting the right data to actually find the poor. And that's less exciting than the elite cap. It's a less exciting problem to solve, but in terms of the magnitude of the problem, it's much bigger. So if we got rid of elite capture, it sounds, I don't know, very romantic to get rid of all this elite capture going on. But it was very much a tiny part of the problem relative to the to the administrative problems that are actually quite large that we really need to get a handle on.
And that people are less interested in, but should be as interested or more interested in, right? Yeah. Another area of your research also focuses on the implications of environmental policy on poor households in developing countries. And you had research in clean cook stoves that exemplifies this. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, so this is a project where we spent, 6 years in the field in India evaluating sort of the medium-run effects of a clean cook stove. And I must say, this is a project where I think it was, for me, a very important project in the sense that when I first started off, there was so much draw about these improved cooking stoves because the problem, just to take a step back, you know, in rural areas, especially in very poor countries, people still cook with firewood. And so the idea is to use a clean cook stove in order to take the smoke out of the household and to improve respiratory health for women and children. So I was so excited when I started this project because I thought we're going to show, you know, we're going to test the impact of the clean cook stove on women and child health. We're going to show that it works and all the amazing things it can do. And it was very disappointing to learn that the cook stoves that we tested actually had no impact. But it was important because these kind of cook stoves, millions of them had been distributed in the past. And so we were distributing this as a solution to a very real important problem, but it was having no impact. And so even though it was disappointing, it was important because if we really want to make a change, we really need to find out what actually works. And so for me, it's really taught me that, you know, we need to take a step back and try to test out different types of cook stoves, try to think about how we're designing the technology to really find a solution to a real problem rather than just say, here's one solution, let's just scale it up to many countries, you know, millions of households without foreseeing, does it actually work?
In India, you also looked at corruption practices at driving schools, discriminative policies in its education system, and the impact of environmental regulations. That's a lot. Could the lessons that you learned from India be applied to other countries in Southeast Asia? Or again, because we're talking about countries with very specific cultural profiles and backgrounds, are they just kind of the learnings in India are specific to India?
You know, I think it's hard to say. So the way I think about evidence is this. You know, if you take evidence from one country to another, it's never going to be perfect because there are differences in the country. But we do learn something underlying about human behavior because, you know, we might all have cultural differences, but we're all the same. We're all human beings in the world. And so when I see a piece of evidence and, you know, and it's very well done, studies that are very well done, it updates my beliefs about what I think about policy solutions. It might not necessarily take me and it completely changed my mind, and it might not tell me this is the right thing I should do here. But if I've learned something in India, I could say, well, I've learned this works in India in this particular way. It's likely that because of these similarities or dissimilarities in Indonesia and Malaysia, it could work in these other ways. So now let's take what we learned, build upon it, and test it here as well. And I think that's where you can really gain a lot from learning across these different contexts.
And while we're speaking about corruption in relation to what you did in India, does corruption look different in different parts of the world? Does it take different forms or, you know, is it like pornography? You know it when you see it.
Hey, God, it's hard to say. I think you know it when you see it.
And have you come across, perhaps it's not fair to ask whether you've come across a silver bullet, but have you identified kind of some of the key ways that we can start working towards ending corruption?
Oh, God, that's a hard question. I don't think there is a silver bullet. And I know that's not, you know, not totally optimistic to say, but I think it's actually optimistic in the sense that I think there are things we can do and make progress on, even if it doesn't solve the problem fully. Because I think there are a lot of different types of policies in place that we've shown to have effects on corruption. So, for example, in Indonesia, some of the work we did showing how transparency in the system, people learning more about these transfer programs actually reduces leakage. But for me, I must actually say this. I actually think the question is also wrong. It's going to sound very weird, but in some ways, if we wanted to get rid of corruption, it's very easy. All you have to do is get rid of the rules. If nothing is illegal, you have no corruption. And in fact, many countries do this. So for example, in Mexico, there were some states that were getting rid of driving licenses because people were paying for their driving license. And so they decided if you didn't have to have a driving license, you have no corruption. And they got rid of corruption. But instead, for me, the work I do, I focus more on how do I improve the service delivery? And in doing so, you try to reduce corruption along the way. But it's more about not just saying creating rules in place that minimize corruption, but creating rules that strengthen what citizens actually achieve. I don't know if that makes the most of sense.
No, that does make sense because, I mean, in the Mexico example, for instance, you've gotten rid of corruption, but you've also gotten rid of road safety.
Yes, exactly.
If you focus
on road safety rather than corruption, you would have had a different policy outcome. Exactly.
Earlier you said, to close off, because you do so many things, earlier you said that one project kind of leads to the next project. How do you decide what to work on next and what do you have next?
Oh, God, that is also another big question. Some academics will have, they have these things that they want to work on and they sit in their office and work on that. I'm not like that. I mean, there are things that I'd like to study and do because I think they're interesting policy questions, but I work very closely with governments because I want to understand what are the problems that policymakers are facing today and what are the policy debates going to be in a year or two so I can generate information that will be useful for the policy space. And so typically to decide what to work on next, I spend a lot of time talking to people, a lot of time learning and trying to figure out how can I be useful. And so there are projects I'm working on right now. For example, we're working on a project on health insurance in Indonesia. That's a very big policy issue. I'm continuing to work on the transfer program there. We've started a project in Pakistan working on the cash transfer program there. So it depends on what's going to be valuable to do, not just for academia, but valuable to do for society.
Thank you very much for coming in. I've been speaking today with Rima Hanna, Jeffrey Chia Professor of Southeast Asia Studies at the Harvard Kennedy School, and we've been discussing her work in improving the provision of public services in developing countries, focusing on the very poor. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.